The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
As a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, joining IAVA.org really helps in the transition home. It's a network of OIF and OEF vets like me who've got your back here, just like we did over there. That means when you need help navigating the GI Bill, we've got your back. And when you're dealing with the transition home, we've got your back. Or when you just want someone to share stories with, we've got your back. Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org. We've got your back.
Brought to you by IAVA and the Ad Council.
Good morning and welcome to this February 5th, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. And as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. We are here every single week talking with authors about their craft, about content, about writing. I'm joined this morning by Susan Steinberg, author of the short story collection Spectacle. And coming up in the second half hour, my favorite psychotherapist, Dennis Palumbo, will be here to discuss his Daniel Rinaldi mystery novel, Night Terrors. Susan Steinberg is the author of Hydroplane and The End of Free Love. She has received a United States Artist Zyprin Fellowship in Literature and the Pushcart Prize. She teaches at the University of San Francisco. Her latest collection is Spectacle. It's published by Grey Wolf Press, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Susan, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I want to give you a chance to take us into this collection and kind of talk about some of the inspirations for it. I know it's very experimental in nature, so I want to get into that a little bit. But talk a little bit kind of what inspired the stories, what you were thinking about when you were putting the collection together, and introduce us to the narrator.
Sure.
Narrators, I should say.
Right, or narrators, right?
We're not sure, right.
I was working on a different project, actually, when I started writing this one. I was working on what may have been a novel, and it just wasn't working out for me, and I was taking breaks from it and working on stories. So, you know, things would come up, and there would be things I wanted to write about that I couldn't work through in this other project. So it's kind of cheating on the novel, I guess, with these stories. And I was suddenly faced with a year-long sabbatical, and I didn't want to use my, you know, one sabbatical in all of these years to work on a novel that really wasn't working out. So I took that year to really focus on short stories, and this collection grew out of that. You know, I think a lot about form. So when I'm asked to talk about what kind of inspired the work or what, you know, I was thinking about when I started writing these, I think I was probably thinking more, or as much, I should say, about form as I was about content, that there was something more satisfying for me in being able to actually finish a piece and, you know, link a story to another story. And I wasn't getting that same kind of, you know, satisfaction out of writing this longer piece that I was working on that I may be returning to. So I was thinking a lot about, you know, structure and how to put together a collection. And, you know, in terms of subject matter, there were things that were coming up that I hadn't written about that I'm addressing in this collection that I was finally able to work through in this, a couple of stories that are, you know, loosely based on the death of my father, a couple of stories based on, you know, I knew a couple of girls who had, or a girl, I should say, that died in a plane explosion, actually, of a Lockerbie, and I was never able to write about that. They were my, a few of the girls were in my college class who were on that plane. So I finally got around to doing this thing that I had pretty much been avoiding writing, I think, and was able to do that, you know, multiple times in the collection. A lot of the stories repeat themselves, and, you know, it's much just more satisfying. I think I said that word 3 times, a project for me to work on at the time.
You know, it's funny that you say that this collection was born out of not wanting to write your other work, because I read somewhere where you said all of these stories started as something I also didn't want to write, that, you know, it was some sort of force of will to make yourself come to either the content or come to this character. So it sounds like a long process in writing what you're trying to avoid writing about.
Right, a long process of avoidance.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think I write around things for a long time before I write them. And, you know, when I finally get the courage together to face the thing or to name the thing, you know, I usually feel a lot better after having done it. But it takes a while for me sometimes to recognize that that's what I'm doing. So I'm not... I think even working on that novel or trying to is in some ways writing around something, and, you know, I'd written 400 pages of it and abandoned it. But I had to do that to really understand how to write this collection. Mm-hmm. And to, you know, again, have the courage to even attempt it.
Right. As I mentioned earlier, it's pretty experimental in nature. I always think that, you know, experimental fiction is sort of like, you know, the classic definition of porn, that I can't define it, but I know it when I see it, sort of. And I was wondering if the experimental kind of implies that it's difficult to define because it's kind of always changing. And sort of your thoughts about making it a little bit more unconventional than your, you know, kind of classic short story form, and mm-hmm. and what you're trying to play with, and what it does for you, what the experimental side does for you.
Well, I can... to writing from painting. I was a painting major as an undergrad in an art school, and I painted for many years. And my writing, it grows out of that. It didn't grow out of being an English major, you know, reading all of the text I was, I'm finger quoting now, supposed to read. Mm. So the text that I, you know, looked at, I did take lit classes as an undergrad, but I also took a great deal of studio classes and art history, and a lot of my writing seems to have, you know, come from what I was doing in that work. And so I've never written in a more sort of traditional sense, and finger quoting again. I haven't written that conventional story. It just didn't start that way. I'm not sort of... abstracting from something that was what I think one would call, what some people call realism. It just came out of the visual arts. So that's part of it. But the easy answer is that I experiment. So, you know, a lot of the experiments fail. You know, I've tried so many things that just haven't worked out. And, you know, and that's okay. I get back into the lab, I try something else, and, you know, maybe something will work, and if it works, maybe I'll try it again in a different way. So for me, a lot of, you know, a lot of writing is just play. It's trying to figure out a new form or a new structure or something new with syntax, something new with punctuation, which I've, you know, been playing around with and I did in my last collection. Just to try on some new things. It's not for me about, you know, being rebellious or not entirely, or, you know, trying to completely undo what's considered conventional in the literary world. I do appreciate that work as well. But I'm really kind of committed, I guess, to my forms fitting the content, and, you know, wanting to build emotion in my story is not only through the what of it, but the how of it.
Yeah, right. They have that quality. I can't remember what the name of those paintings were back in the, or they aren't paintings, but the artwork back in the 80s where it was, you know, like the series of dots, and then you kind of had to stare through it, and then you could see the picture if you kind of let your eyes relax. And then the
like
spaceship
magic
popped
eye
out.
Or something.
Yeah, right, like the magic eye. Yeah, right. And that was similar to these stories, you know, where if you kind of let yourself relax and blend in, you know, kind of bend into it, you could see this wonderful picture. It was really great. You mentioned punctuation, and I wanted to talk about that because you do really interesting things with punctuation. And you said at some point you decided to just replace all of the periods with semicolons. I know there are a lot of writing exercises where teachers have you not use any punctuation at all, that you just, you know, freeform write. And so talk a little bit about sort of what, how you use punctuation as kind of an unconventional tool, and what that shift from, you know, all periods to all semicolons did for the work.
Okay, well, first I'll just say that I really like punctuation and didn't learn how to use it until I was a little bit older. They weren't really big on it in art school, so we weren't learning how to use em dashes and semicolons, all of which I learned when I got to grad school, like really learned, and got really excited about it. I even punctuate every one of my texts, which I suggest that I just suggest everyone do that. But with that, with the three stories that are kind of sentences or fragments strung together by a semicolon, I started to realize when I was writing the first one of those that my clauses, they seem to me to be more like closer or more linked than a period would allow them to be, if that makes any sense. And separating them with a period was giving them too much, there was just too much space between them, and I wanted to pull them in a little closer. And I really love the semicolon and how it does that very thing. So I just wanted to keep uniting these clauses, and I started thinking, well, what if I write a whole story where every clause is that linked to, you know, the clause on either side of it? Would that even work? Would that speed up the story in some way? Would it suggest, you know, that there's more sort of intimacy between sentences or clauses throughout? So I really wanted to try that, and I felt like it worked okay in the first one, for me anyway. And I also start the story with a semicolon and end it with a semicolon, I believe. Just to keep it kind of open-ended, that there could be a clause that precedes the first sentence and one that follows the last sentence. Then my big idea, my failed experiment, was to link two stories, like to write two stories that were so linked that they would be connected by a semicolon, or could be, but I really was just too geeky and I couldn't really hold up. So I just wrote three stories in that form to try to, you know, for me it just helped push the urgency in the story a little bit more than you know, a comma would have just been a series of comma spaces that I really could not have handled.
Yeah.
So I know you're not supposed to use 400 semicolons in a story. I recommend, you know, that my students use them sparingly. But then, of course, I went and completely exploited it.
I think it's just you're not supposed to use that many exclamation points, but I think semicolons are okay. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Susan Steinberg. All right, we are back on with Susan. I sort of lost my train of thought there. But I think we were talking about linking short stories to each other through
titles.
The semicolon, and then the titles, right? And so all of these great dichotomies between your titles that sort of suggest that they're linked together with the cowboy and cowboys and cowgirl, the signifier and signified. So talk a little bit about sort of the stories talking to each other, and this notion that we mentioned earlier of how the narrator may or may not be a unified signal narrator, or if, you know, your narrator may be shifting around.
Thanks. Well, I didn't answer your question before about narrator versus narrators, and you're asking a question about how the stories are linked, or maybe why, in the titles. I do see the stories as each having, each story has its own narrator. I don't see them necessarily as the same girl or same woman throughout. So a lot of readers think it's just one narrator straight through, and I'm completely fine with that read. You know, it can't exactly be the same narrator, because the stories cowboys and cowgirl, for instance, tell the same story, but the details are very different in each. And so I couldn't really, well, I guess it could be the same person remembering in a different way, but some of the details don't quite match up. I suppose I did that on purpose, just to keep, the stories more separate. But I'm happy with either read. I was surprised to find out actually how many people thought that the book was the same narrator straight through. And I guess in some ways they do share so much that it could be. I'm happy either way. But I set out to write each story separately, what each woman has her own story, and didn't want to care too much about matching them up perfectly. And the linking of the stories was not something I had planned going into the project. I hadn't even planned the project when I first started writing them. But I started to see a lot of surprising overlap between them, and then I started realizing, wow, I'm actually writing a collection. And there were things I wanted to retell. So Cowboys and Cowgirls, the same story, retold. And I believe it's Supernova and Spectacle are also similar story told two different ways. But they have other sort of title partners. There's Supernova and Superstar, and there's Spectacle and Spectator. And I wanted to link them formally, so I think there are only four forms in the collection that I'm repeating, and some of, the ones that have that form link up on a sort of emotional level, but not necessarily, in terms of content. So there was a lot to figure out in terms of linking. I'd never written a linked collection before, and so there were a lot of challenges along the way.
Yeah, right. Right. My guest this morning is Susan Steinberg. The book is Spectacle. I was reading a piece about Philip Seymour Hoffman this weekend in Esquire, and they were talking about, kind of the power of him, which reminded me a lot of the power of your short stories, was this ability to, sort of suggest that we're only the sum of all of our secrets, and that, once you return alone to your room, all bets are off. And this, kind of wonderful self-loathing and anger and grief that he was able to conjure up, and all of these really uncomfortable emotions that, all of us really try and shy away from. And he really just, blended into. And these mm-hmm. stories seem to do that same thing, that there was a lot of anger and a lot of discussion of gender roles and what it means to be a woman, but anger around that and frustration around that, and how you don't shy away from the difficult topics. And talk a little bit about kind of keeping your writerly hand to the flame for that sustained period of time, and if it was sort of cathartic for you, if it felt, right and good, or if it was hard to maintain that level of emotional intensity for so long.
Sure. I mean, I think it's both. I feel good after I've pushed all the way through it. When I read the story and I realize it's probably complete, there's nothing more I can add to it at this point, that always feels really great. Like, wow, I've accomplished this. And by accomplished, I don't mean, now I can go get it published, but rather I got this thing out. Like, I actually was able to turn this into something, this painful thing. But the process of writing it has its ups and downs, yeah. For sure. So I have to take a lot of breaks, and I needed a year off to get a lot of it done. I'll write, kind of furiously for an hour, and then I have to go, walk around and do something else for a while. So it wasn't like I was doing this straight through all the time, and I think that would have been really impossible. But it definitely, it feels great and it feels awful simultaneously. I think part of what was fueling this for me, there were a lot of things. Obviously, anger is one of those things. But I was giving readings as I was writing these stories, and a lot more more often than you would think. A female audience member, usually a student, often a student, would approach me afterward and or even during the Q&A and ask, you know, how I was able to write that hard thing, you know, that she was too scared to, or they were too scared to bring something like that to workshop or put something like that on paper, or what if their parents see it? And, you know, I just kept saying, you know, well, when you're ready, you know, write the thing, but try not to be scared of it. If you have this thing that you have to write or that you want to write, just try it. It's better than just keeping it kind of locked up and inside yourself. And I'm, you know, here I am, like, avoiding all these difficult things myself. Right. So it was pretty empowering, you know, like, I have to, thinking I had to take my own advice and get this stuff down, too. And just, you know, once you write one, it's like, oh, now I can raise the stakes. I can try it again in a different way. And I just kept having all these opportunities kept coming up. Like, well, I never wrote that one, and I never wrote that one. So let's see what I can do.
There is endless possibilities of pain to write about, that's for sure.
That is true. It's bottomless pit.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, one thing that struck me as we're talking about your work is that this sort of work might be more, I don't know if it's more difficult to talk about. I mean, sometimes in experimental fiction or the things that you're trying to do, I mean, it's hard enough to talk about your work when it's sort of conventionally written, but your willingness to say, you know, here's what I was trying to do with the semicolons. I was trying to put the words closer together. Or I don't know if some of the magic maybe is lost for you in the dissecting of it and in the talking about it, and if there's some wish for you to just have the work sort of standing out there on its own and letting the readers read into it what they may.
Sure. I mean, it turns out I like talking about it more than I thought I would. I didn't like talking about my paintings. So that was really difficult for me, but I've learned to like talking about the process of writing a lot, maybe because I teach it. But I was thinking as I was talking about the content, that's the thing I tend to avoid talking about. But I love talking about form and punctuation and structure and linking stories and everything about that part of the process. But I shy away from content because, A, it's, you know, difficult to talk about, but probably easier for me to write about. And B, I'm accused a lot of the time of writing, accused is a strong word, nonfiction by strangers, by people who don't know me. And I'm always having to say, you know, no, it's fiction. No, that's actually a story. I made that up. When I start talking about content, it forces me to admit that some of the stuff comes from a real place. And it's difficult, and I, you know, having done that today in this radio show, I thought, wow, I did it. I talked about it. I put it out there. Maybe for the second time.
Wow.
So, you know, I'm getting better at it. I don't think it kills the magic of, you know, the process at all. For me, it actually opens up the dialogue.
Yeah, you had made the observation in another interview, I think with Bookslet, about whether work by women is automatically perceived as some sort of confession. And I do wonder if that happens to women more than it happens to men, if what women write about is seen more as nonfiction. I don't know if it's a gender thing or if it's just a fiction writer plight that people really want the stories to be true.
Sure. Well, I think that gets back to these female students who are coming up to me after the readings, you know, part of their fear was that the other students would think that they were writing nonfiction and that these terrible things really happened to them, you know, or that they were these, you know, terrible people who would do these things in the stories. And so they were just really terrified of being conflated with their narrators. You know, that's part of the thrill for me now is like not caring anymore as much. And, you know, allowing for that blurriness and being okay, I guess, with people thinking that, you know, I stole a car stereo and not my narrator. You know, I just have to live with that fact. I actually did not steal a car stereo. That may be very disappointing to a lot of readers. But, you know, I think it's about you know, the notion of confession, that, you know, women writers confess, that we use this this form as an outlet for, you know, divulging our dark secrets. And confession has, you know, attached to it that we've done something wrong. It's not just that, you know, we have, you know, we did something great and I have to confess this to you.
Right.
It's like something terrible has happened and now I have to tell you what it is. And so I was kind of, I was thinking about that a lot, the notion of confession. I have the word in the book a lot. My narrators are sort of confessing a lot. So I was, you know, I'm intrigued by that idea that women confess as opposed to, you know, having an imagination.
Right. Right. Very interesting. Sadly, we have drawn down on our time. Did we cover everything, or is there something else we should, any advice or anything else we should get out there from your experience?
You know, we covered a lot, and I really enjoyed doing this, despite our technical
difficulties. All of those technical glitches, sorry.
But I guess my only advice to anyone who would be listening to this would just be to write the thing, to not to shy away from it. As soon as, you know, you're ready, just give it a try.
Wonderful. There, tell us where we can find you online. I know there's some great interviews with you on BookSlut and a really great review of this book on there as well. You have Facebook presence, Twitter presence, any of that kind of stuff?
I have no presence.
I have no presence.
I only have, like, real world. Real space presence. So I'm not on Facebook and I'm not on Twitter, which is a whole...
Congratulations.
I could talk about that for hours.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, there are some, I wrote a couple of essays that are, you know, there's one on experimental writing at Publishers Weekly website, and there's one on punctuation at the Grey Wolf website.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Susan, thanks so much for taking the time this morning. It was such a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks. That was Susan Steinberg. The book, the short story collection, is Spectacle. We're going to take a very short break, but when we come back, Dennis Palumbo will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
To see you go, come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
I find this scientifically fascinating. You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. You are able to see what live radio is like this morning when the equipment is only half with us. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. As I mentioned last week, we have a speaker series event coming up next Tuesday, February 11th, the panel of women's fiction authors, four of them. So it's an extra special night. Those seats sell out, so check them out. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Dennis Palumbo. Dennis is a writer and licensed psychotherapist in private practice, specializing in creative issues. His acclaimed series of mystery thrillers, Mirror Image, Fever Dream, and the latest, Night Terrors, all published by Poison Pen Press, features psychologist Daniel Rinaldi. He's also the author of Writing from the Inside Out and a collection of mystery short stories, From Crime to Crime. I would go on. He's got a wonderful bio here on all of the great stuff he's done, but I want to listen to him talk, so we're going to welcome him on. Dennis, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here again.
Always fun to have you on. I always do this to you. We spend the first few minutes talking about the latest book, and then you give us all some fantastic writing and creative therapy for the last 20 minutes. But I really want to talk about Night Terrors, the latest in the Daniel Rinaldi series. So maybe remind our less familiar listeners who Daniel is and kind of the scope of the series, and then introduce us to Night Terrors and what inspired this latest one.
Sure. The series character that I created is named Daniel Rinaldi, is a psychologist who is a trauma expert, and so he specializes in treating the victims of violent crime. And there's three novels so far, and in the debut novel, we learned about how he and his wife were mugged. Coming out of a restaurant, she was killed, and he went through all kinds of survivor guilt, and as a result has dedicated his life to treating victims of violent crime. And he is a consultant to the Pittsburgh police. And let me see, he was born and raised in Pittsburgh. He went to Pitt, has a beard and glasses. So I didn't have to stretch too far in terms of what he was like. The only difference between Daniel and me is he's a lot braver and more resourceful than I am, certainly. But what I like to do in each of the novels is explore some aspect not only of mystery and thriller, because they are essentially procedural thrillers, but also some information about how the mental health world works. You get a good idea into what it's like to be a therapist, what goes on in therapy. And the latest one, Night Terrors, is actually, it comes from a fascinating piece of information I learned. As many of your listeners know, night terrors has always traditionally been a pediatric diagnosis. You know, children who wake up screaming or upset. And they're not nightmares exactly, because unlike nightmares, people who have night terrors don't remember the images. They don't know exactly what was scaring them. They just wake up really scared, and their heart's pounding, and they're sweating, and sometimes they even sleepwalk. Hmm. What's been striking is the rise in the diagnosis of night terrors in adults. And more adults are being treated for night terrors. I have a patient in my practice who's being treated for night terrors. And so I thought, well, which among us, which adult, would probably be most likely to have night terrors? And it occurred to me that an FBI profiler would. This is a person who spent 20 years inside the heads of the worst, most heinous criminals that we know. And so Night Terrors, the novel, is about how the FBI asks Daniel Rinaldi, my hero, to treat one of their retired FBI profilers who's struggling with night terrors. And what makes it particularly difficult is that this FBI agent is on a hit list of an unknown assassin who's going around killing a lot of people. So it's sort of a race against time to try to help this guy and save him at the same time.
Right, right. Talk a little bit about Daniel. This is your third Daniel book, and it sounds like he has a little bit of basis in your life. But talk about him revealing himself over time. You've been with him for a little while now. Does he still have the capacity to surprise you or reveal himself in deeper ways to you? And, you know, maybe talk about sustaining a character over several novels and sort of how he's grown and changed as you've grown and changed.
Well, that's a great question, because he does continually surprise me. I mean, I'm halfway through the fourth one, Phantom Limb, that's going to be out in September. And each novel, I learn more and more about not only how Daniel is as a person, but through his relationships, we also learn a lot about how he handles his own complicated emotions. He's stubborn and angry and dedicated and passionate and funny, but not only does he have, you know, the horrible murder of his wife, that his late wife that he lives with, but we learn about his childhood, the death of his mother when he was three, and his alcoholic father, who was a beat cop, who had, you know, very little regard for Daniel as someone who was sensitive and smart, and got him into amateur boxing. So Daniel was an amateur boxer in his youth, you know, the Pan Am Games and Golden Gloves and stuff, and, you know, trying to please his father. So as the series progresses, we learn more and more about what the impact of these childhood dynamics have on him. And also we see the way the patients with whom he deals, what their experiences do to him, how involved he gets in their lives, where he crosses a line that maybe he shouldn't clinically. And so I tried as much as possible to make him as complicated and multifaceted a character as I could. And also, the thing that I've learned writing the series is that Pittsburgh itself is a character in the novels.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an interesting city because, you know, when I grew up, there were steel mills. I mean, I worked in a steel mill when I was in college. You know, the skies were all dark with soot and smoke. Everybody was a blue-collar person. It was very provincial. And now, you know, 40 years later, all those steel mills are gone. The sky is glistening clean, and it is a pioneer in medical research, nanotechnology, financing. It's become kind of a white-collar town. And so, but all the surrounding industries, you know, steel and coal mining and stuff, are all gone. And it's sort of a tale of two cities. It's got a foot in the past and the foot in the future. You know, you're downtown in Pittsburgh where all these brand-new buildings, you know, silver and glass spires go up into the sky, and 5 miles to the left are cobblestone streets and brownstones and old buildings that have been there for 150 years. And that dichotomy is fabulous for a writer. It's real chiaroscuro, you know, real intense light and real intense darkness.
Right.
And Daniel, as a character, falls between those two.
How often do you go back to Pittsburgh, and how much of a connection do you feel like you have to physically maintain to the city to keep writing about it in fresh ways?
Well, I go back about once a year. I tend to have the book launch always at the Mystery Lovers Bookshop, which is a beautiful little independent store in Pittsburgh. It's been there forever, and I usually do the book launch there. But I also have a lot of friends from college and high school, and I'll ask them questions. You know, I'll just, because the thing about my novels that's so fun is as my readership grows, I'm hearing more and more from Pittsburghers, and all they do is go, "Hey, you can't make a left there on Liberty Avenue." You know, so I usually hear about the mistakes, you know.
Right.
So I have my maps out, and I write my friends and go, "Okay, what's still going? Is the Penn Hotel still there?" You know, and then they write back, no, it's earmarked for demolition." I go, "Oh, okay, well, that's interesting. I could use that." You know, so I tend to write the first draft just out of memory, and then anything specific to the town, you know, I ask friends about and or look up online. So it kind of keeps me fresh. I haven't lived in Pittsburgh for about 40 years. So my memories of it are 40 years old.
Right.
And so the new Pittsburgh remains a real fascinating beast to me.
Readers love that. They love catching writers in mistakes.
Oh, God, yeah.
I think they really try to do it.
Oh, I think they do, too, particularly if you're writing about a city. And so I have to always be careful about that. Also, I'm extraordinarily careful about things in the mental health profession, you know, how things are treated, how things are diagnosed, medications. You know, Daniel's best friend is a paranoid schizophrenic, and I worked in a psychiatric hospital for years and years, so I'm very familiar with patients diagnosed with schizophrenia, and it's a real integral part of the plot, and he's turned out to be pretty much a favorite character for almost all my readers.
How much does your therapy practice feed your characters? I mean, I know probably not directly, you can't draw from life directly, but how much of that practice would you say is sort of soup for the material?
You know, it's funny, not that much. I mean, I certainly don't take any material from my patients to use in the books. Yeah. But what helps keep the novel fresh is my experience as a therapist keeps the kind of context of that relationship alive for me. You know, every day I'm reminded about what it's like to be a therapist, what my patients are going through, how they handle pain, the struggles people have. And so even though I may be, you know, my patients are primarily creative people, you know, screenwriters, TV writers, novelists, directors, people like that, a very different patient pool than my character Daniel Rinaldi deals with. But everybody has operatic passions. Everyone hurts. Everyone yearns, you know. And my patients, working with them every day, reminds me that the characters in my novel are not just chess pieces to move around in a mystery, but that they have deep, deep feelings and deep conflicts. And that's what makes them come alive on the page.
Right. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Dennis Palumbo. The book, the latest in the Daniel Rinaldi series, is Night Terrors. How different was the book from sort of your first thoughts and conceptions of it to the final draft? And, you know, are you a big outliner who sort of sticks to the plan, or does Daniel sort of lead you through the story?
I have never outlined a word of any of my novels. In fact, I'm usually halfway through before I know who the bad guy is.
Hmm.
I just follow my nose. And this way, the novels are as surprising to me as they are to my readers. I mean, the books are the ones, people who know the books know that they have a lot of twists and turns. And what I do is just traditionally, I just all of a sudden write myself into a cul-de-sac and have to figure out how to get out of it. And so part of the fun of writing the novels is I literally don't know what's going to happen next. I may make a decision when I'm starting. Oh, I think I want to set the climax in a steel mill. Or, oh, I want to write a book about how people in a mental hospital deal with the suicide of one of their patients, you know. But that's about all I'll know. I don't know who the patient is. I don't know what happened. And I find out as I write it. I find, particularly being a former screenwriter, that I love writing dialogue, and so it keeps the dialogue real fresh if what people are saying to each other is as much a surprise to me as it is to them.
Right, right. Speaking of writing yourself into a cul-de-sac, I was wondering if it has ever happened to you now that you're on your third, well, now that you're writing the fourth novel, if you have written yourself into an unknown cul-de-sac in an earlier book that now, you know, shoot, his mother's dead, or shoot, you know.
Well, that's what happens sometimes. I'll be writing myself into a situation where I suddenly realize, and this happens all the time, I'll go, well, where the heck did he get the gun? Or,
right.
Wait a minute, how can he ask, you know, Sergeant Polk to help? Sergeant Polk is still in the hospital with his arm in a sling. Oh, damn. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that, and see, what I do is then use it. I would then have my lead character say a version of what I just said, which is, boy, it'd be great to be able to get here, but I can't. He's in a hospital bed with a sling. I use whatever my dilemma is as part of, you know, my the books are told in the first person. And I love writing Daniel's voice. He's like a cooler, smarter, snarkier version of me. And so whatever troubles me about the novel I'm writing, I'll go like, well, gee, maybe she staged her own kidnapping. Well, that would be an interesting turn. So I'll have my lead character say, on the other hand, she might have orchestrated her own kidnapping. You know, so I use what I'm feeling to animate and energize the first-person narrator.
That's great. That's great. My guest this morning is Dennis Palumbo. The book is Night Terrors. I do want to use our last couple of minutes together to talk about tricks and tips that writers can do when they get themselves in these cul-de-sac situations, and sort of methods of tricking yourself and your inner critic, maybe long enough to get back to the work if you're... you talk a lot about writer's block and procrastination, which are two different, very different things, but sort of tips and tricks you use yourself when you're stuck.
Well, writer's block, I mean, you know, there's so much to say about writer's block, but I'll boil it down real simply, which I think writer's block is good news for a writer. I usually think it means that you're about to have a growth spurt in your writing. You're about to push the plot in a different way than you thought. You're about to deepen a character in a way you didn't know. Or you're about to write something that scares you. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's your first sex scene, or maybe it's the first time, you know, you've written a couple short stories, now you're writing a novel, and halfway through you're kind of stuck. I always think that the hard thing about a writer's block is not the block itself, but the meaning we give to it. If we say to ourselves, well, this means I'm never going to be a novelist, or this means this was a bad story in the first place, or, gee, I bet John Updike never got blocked. Whatever, you know, maybe my parents are right and I should have gone to law school. Whatever you want to tell yourself, the meaning is what creates the anxiety. Right. I always think that ask yourself, what is it that you think it means that you're blocked? And then write about that. Just sit down in a separate document and write, if I'm blocked, it means X, it means Y, it means Z. And you'll learn so much about yourself. And the thing that I am absolutely convinced is that for most people, and I know this is true for me, most people find that creative blocks are like developmental steps. You know, if you watch a baby, a toddler learning to walk, it gets up, it falls down, it gets up, it falls down. It has to learn to navigate that developmental step, and then it starts to walk. Most really good writers have five or six big blocks and developmental steps as they grow as a writer. And to me, the proof of this is I've never known a writer, myself included, who hasn't worked their way through a block, who doesn't feel they're a better writer on the other side of it. Mm. I think it's a learning tool. It is a developmental step in your growth as a writer. So if you can reduce the panic and just work the problem, I think it's the best way to deal with the block. It goes from being a negative to a learning experience.
I guess the next the corollary question is abandoning a project that isn't working and knowing when to trust that you're just blocked and you need to work through these steps versus this project is just kind of crappy and I should let it go.
Well, I've had many of those. I think there are times when you just go, this isn't working. I think if you can put it away without shame, it's fine. Hmm. If you can say, well, you know, I've had like four unfinished novels over my last 40 years and about 12 unfinished screenplays when I was a screenwriter, which, you know, I'm retired from now, but when I was in show business. And if you put it in your drawer and say, God, I'm terrible. This doesn't work. Who am I kidding? Then it's a bad thing to put that script or that book away. If you can put it away as saying, this isn't working, I'm going to try something else, without giving it the meaning that it says something about you, then I think it's totally fine to do that. In my experience, material has a very long shelf life. In my second novel, Fever Dream, the whole middle of that novel is a revised version of a big chunk of an unfinished novel from 12 years ago.
Wow.
That didn't work, but there was a big chunk of it that I always knew worked great, and I couldn't wait to figure out someday I'd have a way to use it. So I always say don't delete it, just stick it in a drawer, because You never know when a piece of writing, you're going to realize a way to either fix the problem that you had or somehow in some other form use that material. The key to all of this is to have a benign relationship with your writing process, to be sort of pro-you in terms of your writing, so that whether you're blocked or whether you're putting things away because they don't work, they don't become artifacts that prove there's something wrong with you, but rather just grist for the mill. Being a writer is tough. Being a good writer is really harder. And that's the struggle. It's not for sissies. Writing is not for wusses.
I love that. And you always say the goal of therapy is not to become some perfect version of you. That's, the goal is not perfection.
Yeah, there is no perfectible version of yourself. As I've said, I think even on this show, I've had so many patients over the years say, gee, if I could just take all of my doubts and fears and insecurities and shove them out the door, then I would sit down at the keyboard and write. And I always say, write about what?
Yeah, right. Right.
You've got to bring all that stuff back in, or else it's not going to relate to anyone. You know, the thing that Emerson said is still so true, that to know what is true for you in your private heart, that is true for everyone, that is genius. And so bring all the very things that you use to beat yourself up, your doubts, your insecurities, use all of those. Give them to your characters. Use them to make what you're writing personally relevant and relatable to your reader.
Great, great advice. Tell us before you go how we can find you on the web and find you.
Well, I have a website that is cleverly called DennisPalumbo.com. DennisPalumbo.com. And you can read about my books and where my, you know, the appearances I'm going to be doing. And there's a lot of articles in there that people might find helpful as well.
Yeah, you do a great column for Psychology Today called Hollywood on the Couch, which has so much helpful advice for writers. I highly recommend that too.
You should be my PR person, because I never remember half this stuff.
I'm happy to do that.
And yeah, I have my column has turned out to be kind of fun for a lot of people.
Cult following, yeah. No, absolutely. It's a fantastic column. Fantastic column. Dennis, this was a huge pleasure, as it always is. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me again.
Thanks again. Bye-bye. That was Dennis Palumbo. The book is Night Terrors. It's out and available now. That's all the time we have for this morning. Barbara will be back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Stay tuned for Roots and Rhythms coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Have a great day.